Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. 73% of eligible voters in Spain cast their ballots in last Sunday's snap elections. The Socialist Workers' Party won 123 of the 350 seats in parliament, but fell short of an outright majority. The far-right, anti-immigrant, anti-feminist Vox Party, which was backed by Steve Bannon, won 10% of the vote and will enter parliament for the first time with 24 seats. Joining us to talk about media coverage and what's next for Spain is Carlos Del Clos, a sociologist and editor for Roar Magazine, an independent journal providing grassroots perspectives from the front lines of the global struggle for real democracy. Carlos wrote an op-ed for The Guardian about Spain's election, and you can find that at yourcallradio.org. And Carlos joins us from the beautiful city of Barcelona. Hi, Carlos. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Carlos, in the United States, reading about a turnout, is it 78%, actually? I think I got that wrong. 78%, which is so incredibly high. We can only dream of that here in the U.S. In fact, turnout in our last presidential election was just 58%. Almost half the country did not vote. So what explains these huge numbers?
Well, I mean, first off, Spain's only had a democracy for like 40 years at this point, a formal democracy. And as a result, I think that might have something to do with why participation's actually usually substantially higher than we're used to in the United States. So about 78% of voters participated in these last elections, but in the previous ones, you know, they had kind of a record low turnout, and it was close to 60%. So that just kind of gives you an idea of what the range is like. Now, that said, it was the highest degree of participation in a long time. So mobilization really did play an important role.
So what else can you tell us for those who aren't familiar with how the government works in Spain? Can you just give us a quick overview before we dive into the results and what they mean?
Sure. So Spain has a parliamentary democracy, right? And it has a multi-party system that revolves around like three axes, right? On the one hand, you have the left and the right, with left-wing parties like the center-left party there is called the Socialist Party. It's not actually a socialist party, although it is rooted in a socialist party from the First International. So it's about 140 years old. But they have a range of parties on left and right. Podemos is kind of an upstart left-wing party that came out of the Indignados movement, which was kind of the precursor to Occupy, for instance, in the United States. And they emerged on the scene in 2015. But then on the other side, on the right, this year you had three right-wing parties, which were Ciudadanos, like kind of a liberal, centrist, technocratic type of thing. The Popular Party is the historical party of the right, and then Vox, which is this ultra-nationalist party. And at the same time, you have a lot of regional parties that are kind of specific to places that have that are stateless nations. So Galicia, the Basque region, and Catalonia, places with their own languages and their own histories and so on, that have a lot of tension with the central state in Madrid. So in these elections, what basically united the right was a hardcore centralist pro-Spain stance that had them kind of competing to see who had the harshest stance against the Catalan parties and their bid for independence. And I know that's kind of a lot that I just let go right there, but it's a very complex system in a very complex place.
Yeah. And talk about why this general election happened in the first place. What is a snap election exactly?
Sure. So this election happened. This election happened 9 months after a coalition, a left wing coalition with the Socialist Party and Podemos, the left wing party, as well as the regional nationalist parties. They basically came together and held a no confidence vote to boot the conservative president at the time, Mariano Rajoy, because his party got busted in a major corruption scheme. You know, they were found guilty of corruption. So 9 months after that, they were negotiating a budget for the year, and they needed an absolute majority made up of these three groups that supported the vote of no confidence. They could not come to an agreement because the Catalan parties were, you know, negotiating with the central with the socialists who were pro Spain for the right to self determination, and because the socialists didn't want to concede on that point. And neither did the Catalan independence parties. They held snap elections, which is what we had on Sunday.
So tell us about the Socialist Workers' Party. What is their main platform?
I mean, their main platform is a standard, you know, centrist kind of social democratic model that's, you know, pretty common to center-left parties throughout Europe. They want, you know, at the same, you know, they're pro, they're socially liberal, I would say. Mm-hmm. They're pro gay marriage. Spain legalized same-sex marriage, in 2005, and then they're also in favor of social spending. They're in favor of universal health care. They're in favor, actually, of universal health care, truly universal. That means for people that are undocumented as well. Spain's had this for, you know, had this for a while. The conservatives got rid of it, and then the socialists have tried to bring it back. So that's kind of their supposed to be their program. Over time, however, they've kind of taken more and more neoliberal positions, and, you know, gone in the direction of the third way, the Tony Blairite, Hillary Clinton type of, you know, just kind of have more diversity at the top type of, you know, liberalism.
The conservatives got rid of health care? Is that what you said?
Well, no, the conservatives, what they did, because Spain is a country where, you know, even 60% of conservative voters favor universal health care for the undocumented. Nevertheless, riding on, you know, this sort of national populism, racist fascism that's kind of going around Europe at the time, and you know, you guys kind of know a little bit about it in the U.S. too. They decided to take the undocumented out of the universal healthcare system. This happened in about 2012, 2013. And this was, you know, a lot of people were really upset about it. When the socialists got back into the government with the help at the insistence, actually, of Podemos and other parties, they reinstated universal healthcare.
So let's talk about the rise of the far right in Spain. The fascist and far right parties have made inroads in many EU countries, Italy, Hungary, Poland. You wrote about the far right in Spain in your piece for The Guardian, which people can find at yourcallradio.org. You write, first and foremost is the rise of Vox, a new openly misogynistic and xenophobic party that toys with nostalgia for Franco's dictatorship. Backed by the likes of Steve Bannon, Marine Le Pen, and Matteo Salvini, and indirectly financed by a U.S. super PAC with ties to Donald Trump, a Russian oligarch and Italian MP Lucia Valonte, who is accused of bribery, Vox rode a wave of anti-Catalan sentiment into the government. Sunday's massive turnout was most likely driven by widespread fear of a right-wing coalition government that would include it. So several of those names are very familiar to people in the U.S. Backed by the likes of Steve Bannon, what role did he play in this election, and how closely connected is he to Vox?
Well, I mean, Steve Bannon is very clearly, you know, with his movement thing, throwing money around in Europe right now. And you can read about this actually in on opendemocracy.net. They did an investigative report that revealed all of this kind of stuff. You can just check out opendemocracy.net and look for their story on Citizen Go, which is basically they're trying to, you know, they're throwing around money all over Europe supporting far-right movements in a lot of these countries that you mentioned. And what they're trying to do is basically import the super PAC model from the United States. And that's the Open Democracy Report. Their investigation has them saying this quite explicitly, at least the representative in Spain who kind of heads up this this very hardcore right organization that goes around basically agitating in very reactionary ways. But they provide a lot of information on that. Bannon's role in this is basically, you know, through this movement thing to be putting a lot of the money, in these types of organizations.
And can you talk about where the money is coming from? I mean, how much money are we talking about?
That I don't know. I'm not an expert on this. I basically just referred to this investigation that made its way into the Spanish papers and through the Open Democracy kind of their report. They have a lot more details on this than I have myself.
What kind of coverage does Steve Bannon get in Spain in the local media?
Well, Bannon, you know, he has this type of coverage that that he's gotten a lot of in the United States, which is like this kind of, oh, who's this compelling genius, you know, that that was able to, you know, trick Americans into voting for Donald Trump and all of this. So, you know, he gets these kinds of profiles in mainstream newspapers, right? But at the same time, it's not like he's not as as well known a figure as he is in the United States, of course. But he's very much associated. I think he's going to take a bigger role in the upcoming European elections as like a topic, right? Which isn't the European elections are at the end of May of this month, and precisely because of these types of efforts, I think he's going to be on the public agenda a little bit more. But it's Yanis Varoufakis has already been talking about this fascist international or the nationalist international or something like that, which is what is often associated with Bannon's attempts to become a player in Europe.
So how significant is this? What's interesting here is Washington Post reporter James McCauley said Vox performed well below expectations. He says Vox was supposed to do much better than it did. Its entry into parliament is clearly huge, but really not the story tonight. And then Jacobin reports that up until 2018, Spain had no equivalent to hard or far-right forces like France, like Germany, Italy. Yet this apparent anomaly also masked something going on under the surface, which finally became apparent with the election last December. In the vote in Spain's biggest region, the far-right Vox Party achieved institutional representation for the first time, helping lift to power a coalition of the mainstream center-right. So what are your thoughts? How significant is this?
Well, I mean, I think it's a big deal, and I think it's really bad news. Commentators had talked a lot about the so-called Spanish exception to this rise of the far right everywhere. But what we're seeing through Vox, the amount of votes that they got has them at about equivalent of AfD in, I think, their first elections, their first major elections in Germany, Alternative for Deutschland, which is the far right party over there. The thing with Vox, there's a lot of tricks involved in this because it's often said that, okay, this is the first time the far right has representation in the parliament. I don't think it's necessarily that something's happening underneath the surface of Spanish society, necessarily. I think it's happening underneath the surface of the former ruling right-wing party, which is the Partido Popular, the Popular Party. They had originally, been able to house a lot of different sensibilities from, kind of centrist liberals to the far right, Franco nostalgia, all this kind of stuff, and all around this kind of national Catholic pro-business agenda. So when that massive corruption case, when they were finally found guilty of corruption, this, created a situation where they just started hemorrhaging votes. So they basically are splitting. We're witnessing them decay into all of the constituencies that they'd originally held. So I'm not really sure that Spain is more fascist today than it was before. I think in Spain there is still, something of a memory of the years of the dictatorship, which was only 40 years ago, after all. And what is, the living memory that is kind of passing away right now is the memory of the Spanish Civil War, which is why I think people could look at a party like Vox with its open Franco nostalgia and really kind of forget that, it wasn't so long ago that, the dictatorship was what was going on in Spain, right? That the Civil War happened. And so they'll kind of harp on the wedge issues that were that sparked that civil war, but this has been, the unresolved tensions from all of this have been at the heart of Spain's transition to democracy, from its very beginning in 1978.
And what is Vox's platform? The party is using the same language as Donald Trump. They propose to, quote, make Spain great again. What stands out in their platform?
Well, they have this, you know, Spain is a very old country in a sense. They have this very very deep memory, I guess. That the nostalgia that they're calling upon isn't like the 1950s like it was in the United States. It's the reconquest of 1492, right? They're talking about Spain as like this bastion of civilization against, you know, the gays and the Muslims and women, you know, and all these people that have gained liberty in the last 500 years, you know. So it's a very racist project. It's literally a national Catholic, right, project. This is, you know, 1492 was a moment that, you know, colonization began, that Spain was united under the Catholic kings, and also that the Inquisition began. So these three axes are the center of their political nostalgia. They've used really goofy ads to bring these points up, but then they also mix that with like American style conservatism and its pro-gun agenda and its sort of, you know, frontiersman type of, you know, alpha male on a horse type of thing. So it's a very strange beast indeed.
How are the media covering Vox and their platform in Spain?
Too much. They're covering them way too much. I mean, it's this sort of thing that, like, you know, years ago, this party didn't just emerge this last year. This party has existed for some time, and they were always a joke. But at some point, the media basically started to give them some space to talk about the crazy things they do on social media, to look and laugh at all the crazy things they say, talk about all the fake news stories that they spread through WhatsApp and, you know, on social networks. And of course, you know, they gain this visibility, and, you know, now they become a major political player.
It sounds like how Donald Trump was covered in the United States, and in many cases is still covered in this country.
Yeah, it's the dumbest thing you can do, because people will say, oh, it's, you know, freedom of speech. But freedom of speech, you know, that means you can say anything. It doesn't mean that everybody gets to be on the news, right?
Right. Today we're speaking with Carlos Del Colos, a sociologist and editor for Roar magazine. That's an independent journal providing grassroots perspectives from the front lines of the global struggle for real democracy. Carlos wrote an op-ed for The Guardian about Spain's election. It took place last Sunday. The Socialist Workers' Party won 123 of the 350 seats in parliament, and the anti-immigrant, anti-feminist Vox Party, which was backed by Steve Bannon, won 10% of the vote. They will enter parliament for the first time with 24 seats. And Carlos is going to be with us for about 7 more minutes. So if you have any questions for him about what is happening in Spain's election, it got quite a lot of attention in the United States. The Nation wrote a great piece. The Washington Post actually wrote a very lengthy piece. Carlos and Applebaum traveled to Madrid and talked to people about what they were seeing on social media. It was a really long, in-depth story. The New Yorker, a lot of U.S. publications are covering this. So if you have any questions for Carlos or any thoughts about the coverage, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Carlos, you tweeted out The Nation's piece. Have you been reading any of the mainstream coverage here in the United States about the election in Spain and the analysis?
I mean, yeah, for a time I've been following some of the coverage in the New York Times. Rafael Minder has done a very good job, you know, reporting on that. And a lot of Megan Beatley actually had a really good piece in The Atlantic recently about the incredible women's strike that took place in Spain and the women's movement that emerged around it, and also the court case that kind of, you know, sparked a lot of outrage in Spain, but also, you know, was sort of taken advantage of by Vox and the far right to ignite their ultimately rather impotent chauvinistic discourse, I'd say, from the last election results. So yeah, there's been a lot of good writing actually on Spain, and I think people are saying that it's kind of a laboratory for a very, you know, complex type of new politics that's emerging.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I was going to ask you, I mean, people keep speaking in very simplistic terms about the Donald Trump effect around the world. But what effect do you think this administration had, if any, on the elections in Spain?
Well, I mean, whatever the what Trump managed to do was shift the narrative and get a lot of attention to the rise of the far right, I guess, because it's so, you know, dire that he would take power in the United States. But I think, you know, there's more interesting things happening in Spain, and Spain's kind of been a forerunner for a lot of things that have happened since the global financial crisis, since it was hit so hard, yet responded in this very left-wing way. Mm. I think one of the things that we saw in Spain over these last days is that when the Socialist Party goes left, the far right doesn't quite stand a chance. What the far right has been able to do is shift a great deal of the political center towards them, and that's what you know Donald Trump is managing to do, I guess. By just forcing you to talk about him, but what the, you know, by having a, you know, an authentic movement derived left wing, you know, populism or in Podemos, what the socialists kind of did was they said, look, we can govern in another way with pressure from them, because they're actually democratic, and what they want to do is provide more things, you know, good things for more people. So if we don't go to the center with the far right, then I think, you know, we have a better chance. Now, that's very fragile on the part of the socialists. They, you know, they're center left and they're very weak, and they can eventually go back on other issues. For instance, on immigration, I don't think that there's much progress at all. I think they've eaten the right's line, hook, line, and sinker. So, you know, I think one of the lessons is that if you show people that it's possible to govern on the left, and, you know, you give them a reason to believe that there is an alternative to this sort of, you know, nationalist enclosure and just closing off to the rest of the world and going back to these old ways. And I think they would be wise, both the socialist parties and social democrat parties in Europe and progressive parties everywhere would be wise to, you know, realize that if you stay left and if you stay away from the far right and you mark a difference with them that's meaningful and that plays out in people's lives, you know, they don't have to win.
Hmm. We have about a minute left, Carlos. What are your thoughts about the coalitions? Because I understand that in order to form a coalition, you need 176 seats. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. And so the Socialist Workers Party won 123 seats. So what are your thoughts about what kinds of coalitions are going to create?
Well, right now they're going to be posturing a lot because there's local and regional elections in a month, and they're going to have to see how things play out after that to see which way they go. I think what the socialists can do is they can either pact with Podemos and the support of the regionalist parties and, you know, instill kind of a democratic left, you know, progressive, let's say, agenda that decentralizes power, or they could go in the direction of Ciudadanos, who, you know, summed up with the PSOE, do have a majority, but that would be going towards the kind of centrist kind of technocratic approach, with the sole purpose of, you know, maintaining the unity of Spain. So in that sense, you basically just confirm the far right's nationalist discourse. So I think that would be a disaster. And I wonder if what the socialists might do is say, okay, we're going to try to govern on our own. We're not going to have Podemos in the actual government, but we're going to rely on their support to get to run the government, and B, get legislation passed. And that would require, you know, support from Podemos and from the regional nationalist parties. But no matter who they get support from, they're going to try to govern on their own, I think, because that frees them up to pact with whoever, you know, whoever they want. They would be kind of the steering wheel of Spain.
Carlos Delcalos is an editor for Roar magazine, an independent journal providing grassroots perspectives from the front lines of the global struggle for real democracy. That's Roar magazine, R-O-A-R. He wrote an op-ed for The Guardian about Spain's elections, and you can find that at yourcallradio.org. Carlos, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you all.
Thank you. Carlos was joining us from Barcelona. Coming up after the break, we will speak with Katie Murphy, who's a reporter with the Mercury News. She and Caitlin Bartley wrote an extensive story about the housing crisis in Northern California called The Price We Pay. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about media coverage of the Bay Area's housing crisis. In an interactive piece called The Price We Pay, Bay Area News Group reporters Katie Murphy and Caitlin Bartley report that in 2012, 70% of Bay Area neighborhoods were affordable to families making the equivalent of $100,000 today. That's 70% of neighborhoods. Today, only 28% of neighborhoods are affordable to those same families. Using an exclusive zip code level analysis, they spent months looking at how the housing crisis is transforming Northern California. Joining us to discuss this report is Katie Murphy. Katie covers housing and state government for the Mercury News and the East Bay Times. Hi, Katie. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us, and thank you for writing this in-depth story. The interactive elements of the piece are, gosh, kind of just shocking just to see how things have gotten so much more expensive, not only in San Francisco, but even up north in Santa Rosa, which is about an hour north of San Francisco for people outside of the area. Tell us about how you went about this. It's what you call a first-of-its-kind analysis in partnership with the real estate firm Zillow, giving an alarming new view of the depth and the breadth of the Bay Area's unprecedented housing crisis.
Well, we have been, as a team, we've been covering the housing crisis for the past year and a half or so, and writing almost daily about people affected by it, or their latest reports about average rents going up or home prices. But we really wanted to step back and take a bigger look at what was going on, what had happened over time, and really going to a granular level, neighborhood by neighborhood, because I think some people might just assume, well, sure, it's really expensive in much of San Francisco or San Jose, but there have to be affordable areas elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So we really wanted to drill down. We got data. There's no perfect rent data out there, but we got estimates from Zillow for multifamily. So this doesn't even include more expensive rental houses. We looked at the median market rate rent each year for apartments, condos, or townhomes based on this index that they compile of all of the housing stock in a given zip code, not just the units that are listed for rent in a year. So they give you the median for their best guess of what the median market rate rent is each year in each zip code. We went back to 2012.
And you looked at more than 225 zip codes across the 9-county Bay Area and Santa Cruz County since the tail end of the real estate bust in 2012. And the one thing that is just, I think it just says so much about where we are, is when you go to the story, and I hope listeners can check this out, you can find it at yourcallradio.org. There's an interactive map of the Bay Area region, and it shows you how much and how affordable things were at one time, where you could actually get, well, I should say affordable for some people. I mean, you could actually get still a place for, say, $900 a month, which these days, that's really hard to come by. And I'm looking right now in the Santa Rosa area, and this was in 2012. And as you scroll down, you look at 2013, 2014, and it just keeps getting darker and darker until all of a sudden the Santa Rosa area goes to about $900 a month to $2,500 a month. So, I mean, we're seeing just drastic increases over the course of 6 years.
Yeah, I mean, when I first saw this, I had seen the numbers on a spreadsheet, but when I first saw this, when our graphic artist, Pi, put this together on this interactive heat map and I started scrolling through, I couldn't believe what I was seeing and just how dramatic the changes were. On the mortgage side as well as the rent, I didn't mention before, but we also looked at what it would take to buy a home or at least to afford the monthly mortgage payment through the years. And so that doesn't even take into account the larger and larger down payments that are required to afford more expensive homes, but just showing how that has gone out of reach. So more people have to rent, and then they're, you know, they're vulnerable to changes in the rental market.
Well, I'd love to give out the phone number. If you have any questions or comments, this issue gets a lot of attention across the country because so many people are talking about what's happening in the Bay Area, but the affordable housing crisis is also happening across the country. So what are your thoughts about the media coverage of this? And if you have any questions for Katie about what she found, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. So you came up with a number of findings in this piece. A dwindling choices, for example, as prices have jumped, lower and middle income families are being pushed out of entire cities and sometimes whole counties. I mean, we're hearing about people who are just leaving the state altogether because it's so hard to find housing. So tell us more about dwindling choices.
We found that if one of our findings was that if you make less than $64,000 a year, so that would be even more than if you had a couple and each person was making the minimum wage or even a $15 an hour minimum wage and working full time with their combined incomes, they could not afford the median market rate rent in any zip code in the entire area that we covered. And that was not true. I just actually checked because some people have responded to that and said, well, what would you expect? Because, you know, they're minimum wage earners. You wouldn't expect that they would be able to afford the median rent anywhere. But actually, in 2012, even if you adjust that to $2012 dollars, there were places that had rents that, you know, the median rent was affordable mm-hmm. on that income. There weren't a ton, but they existed. Right. And now they don't exist. We also looked at, we chose $100,000, household income because it's a round number. We thought it would resonate with people. And also it's, just under the region median household income. And we found in that case, you pointed this out earlier, that, there are just fewer and fewer places, especially if you look, at San Francisco County, Alameda County, Santa Clara, San Mateo, and Marin, the counties right by where all the jobs are. There are even fewer of those zip codes that are affordable to people making $100,000.
Well, wow, $64,000. So this is two workers making $15 an hour. Not a single neighborhood last year had an affordable median apartment rent. The cheapest option was in Vallejo with a median rent of $1,602. But even that was out of reach for 35% of the region's households. Today, we're speaking with Katie Murphy. She covers housing for the Mercury News and the East Bay Times. She and Caitlin Bartley spent months on this piece called The Price We Pay. And hopefully you can find this online because it is interactive and it just shows you just how drastically things have changed over the last 6 years. And let's go to a few callers. Let's hear from Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. And it's a good program. My question is simply this. What's the political establishment in this country, in California, dominated by the Democrats largely, going to do, proposing to do to cope with this crisis?
Yes, that's a very good question. Katie, what about that? Let's first talk about what's happening in Sacramento. How are politicians proposing to deal with this crisis?
Well, there have been, in the past several years, there have been hundreds of bills each year with various solutions to address what's going on in the Bay Area and elsewhere. There are different camps. Some people are exclusively focused on increasing the supply of housing by making it easier more housing density to be built in areas where people don't necessarily want more apartments, or to make it easier for developers to build. And then there's other people who say, well, that's important, but that is going to take many years or decades to make a difference for people who are really in a crisis situation now. So we need to also make pass laws that protect tenants. Those are much harder to pass in Sacramento. There's a pending package of bills right now, that including one that would create a rent cap statewide in places that for any unit that's not already under rent control. Right now, as written, it would be 5% plus the inflation for the given year. I'm sure. I'm imagining that number will go up as this bill makes its way through the legislature. But it did pass its first committee hearing last week. I was there to cover that. And there's also a bill to make it harder to evict tenants without giving a reason, or if a tenant has been paying their rent. Places like San Francisco already have these rules on the books, but for elsewhere in the state where there aren't any protections for renters. So I guess it's a combination. There's people working on the supply side, and then there's also these pushes to make it to stabilize rent for tenants.
And what are you hearing from the national politicians, like Nancy Pelosi? I mean, she represents San Francisco. Kamala Harris, Dianne Feinstein. What are they proposing? How do they propose to deal with the housing crisis?
It's funny because I'm sure they have. I haven't heard that. I haven't been following that very closely. I mean, housing is. It's such a localized issue in some ways, and the people who have the power to set policy on what gets built and where, and what kind of protections are in place for tenants. I mean, it's so local that it's even controversial that the state is trying to get involved in trying to push this. I probably should know the answer to that, but I haven't been following it all that much.
That's okay. Actually, the East Bay Times, where you work, your colleague Casey Tolan wrote a piece about Kamala Harris's renter's tax credit. She introduced a plan that would give renters that spend more than 30% of their income on rent and utilities a credit depending on their income, and allow beneficiaries to receive monthly checks from the government instead of getting it once a year through a tax refund. So that's just one plan. And I mean, what's the best way people can follow, as you said, hundreds of housing bills? I mean, you write, you do a great job of it. Cal Matters does a great job of reporting on this. But for people who really want to get involved and follow housing legislation to find out when committees are going to do, markups and have hearings, what's the best way people can find that information?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. There are so many different people that are tracking. I think following me, you mentioned Matt from Cal Matters, and Liam Dillon from the LA Times does a lot of housing coverage too. I'm trying to think. There are groups that follow. I know that ACE, which is an organizing group.
Oh, did we just lose Katie? Katie, are you with us?
Yeah. Oh,
okay. Go ahead.
Okay. So there are different organizations that will track some bills, but it's hard to keep track of all of them. But you can find, if there's a bill that you are interested in, you can go to, there's a state website, legislative, Ledge Info website, and you can look up a bill and see its progress and who voted for it and who voted against it.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Max. Let's go next to Noel in Oakland. Hi, Noel. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Glad to talk to you. I really appreciate the concern people are putting into this issue, but the policy considerations that are being proposed are really just so much of rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, and the issue of false framing comes to mind, because You know, the question of this being a crisis is absurd. You cannot refer to a planned event as a crisis. And, you know, I come from a Freemasonic family, and essentially generating, rigging markets so as to create a game of genocidal musical chairs through the housing crisis and criminalizing poverty and then driving people into medical indigency is just a way of exterminating populations. I come from a family of Freemasonry. We are the cult of G. We own you. We program you. That's why
thank you for calling in. Katie, let's actually talk about how we got here, because, you know, when you talk about San Francisco, you hear about tech, about all the IPOs. Lyft just went public. Uber is about to go public. A number of other companies went public, which are going to create millionaires overnight, just like that happened with Twitter. I believe 1,200 millionaires were created overnight. So you have that happening. And then you also have, during the financial crash, a number of private equity firms bought single-family units. So you have that happening. And we actually have Rob, who just wrote in and said there were a lot of articles during the Great Recession detailing how hedge funds were buying up foreclosed houses and holding them as rentals. One would assume that those units are no longer turning over on the market as they naturally would. Is this contributing to these rising prices?
I think definitely. I mean, it's actually something that I'm looking into right now. But what we did see was, at least I know it for sure in Oakland, Urban Strategies Council did an extensive study years ago and found that that over 40% of the foreclosed properties in Oakland were bought by investors. In some cases, they were most likely flipped, and in other cases, they were turned into rental housing. So there were a lot of homes that were previously owner-occupied that are now being rented out. And for and as most people listening to this probably know, single-family homes in California are all exempt from rent control,
right,
by state law.
And according to CalMatters, Blackstone, the private equity firm that's publicly traded on Wall Street, is the largest owner of single-family homes nationwide. Here in California, they own 13,000 homes.
Yes. So that was something that investors were able to, with aid from the federal government, were able to buy these homes for, for pennies on the dollar back in, during the crisis, the last crisis, and now are a lot of times renting them out for, they've ridden the wave up.
Okay, so what else contributes to this crisis? We've got tech, we've got IPOs, private equity firms buying single family homes. What else contributes?
Well, I just think that there's widening income inequality in the Bay Area too. So it's, there's all of these, there's population growth on one hand, more people are coming in because there's all this job growth here. And there's also just looking at, there are just more people, there's just more money in the Bay Area, but it's not going around to everybody. So I think that is, further exacerbating the situation for people who haven't seen huge wage increases during the tech boom. So there's definitely the people who are riding the wave of the tech boom, and those who aren't. And there is an underlying shortage of homes, there have been more jobs created than homes built. So that's a decades in the making, that problem. So that can't be fixed overnight either.
You share a number of stories from people who are struggling to find housing and to make their monthly payments. You also got so much attention on your piece online and on social media. What really stands out for you, just thinking about the people that you interviewed and the reaction that you got from this story?
Well, I just, the families I talked to were their stories moved me a lot. We have this one family living in San Leandro, which is in Alameda County, just south of Oakland, and the dad is, you know, works at Costco as a meat cutter, and earns what you would think is a decent salary, about $70,000 a year. Mm-hmm. But they have a family. They've got three kids who are 11 to 17 years old in a two-bedroom apartment, and the parents sleep on the living room floor every night because they can barely even afford the rent that they're paying now, and that's below the median rent in their zip code. And so they can't even, they're worried about even just holding on to the place that they have. But I think I was just generally struck by sacrifices like that, and what people are doing and have to do to stay here.
I mean, you report also that Vallejo in 2012, the median mortgage payment on a new purchase would have been $570 a month. Today, it has nearly tripled to $1,470. So, you know, a couple years ago, we would hear about people moving north, and now it's so expensive even up north. Mm-hmm. So what are you hearing from people who are leaving the area altogether? I mean, I was struck also by families that you interviewed who are traveling 4 hours a day mm-hmm. because they cannot work or they can't live near their work.
Yeah, I mean, that to me is, I mean, that was the other thing that really jumped out to me, especially if you look at the map over time and then compare that to all the stories that you hear. San Francisco has always been really expensive, but there were places in Oakland, you know, right across the bridge where they could go and afford to live. And now to find those more affordable places, and they're still not cheap, but they're you have to go further and further out. The family from San Leandro were saying that all their friends are telling them, get out, move to the Central Valley, go to Manteca where it's cheaper. But they said that they found that the rents there were so high and the home prices were so high that it wouldn't, you know, they didn't even know if they could afford that.
Where do you see this going, Katie? I can't imagine that over the next 5 years we're going to see the same trajectory. It's so hard to think that that is even possible. But when you crunch your numbers and you talk to people, what do they say about what's to come?
I've been trying to get people to answer that question, and there are a lot of different factors. Some people think that if there is another downturn, that will put a chill on everything. I mean, the rents have leveled out over the past year or so in San Francisco, but they're still so high that even if they stay flat or go down slightly in some of these places, it's still not going to make them affordable, you know, unless they drop way down to where they were a few years ago. So there are just a lot of people who've thought about the future and where's the Bay going? Where will we be in 50 years from now or something if these different scenarios play out? But it's really hard to predict. But I can't imagine that the rents are going to go down to where they were a few years ago.
Let's take one last caller. Let's go to Carla in Oakland. Hi, Carla.
Hi, Rose. Wow, I can't even begin to say how important this topic is. Number one, I'm an Oakland native. I'm an artist. I've been teaching at the college level now for 20 years. I have booked a trip starting next week. I'm going to leave for an extended weekend to New Mexico because I have to search for another place to live. And what it means for me is I'm leaving my whole extended family because I've done, last summer I spent a lot of time doing my financial future, kind of looking at what I would be living on if I retired or left teaching here in the Bay Area. You know, I really think this last recession that we had, that the first kind of dot-com bomb that when everything exploded and people's homes were foreclosed on, you know, I almost feel like the same thing is happening again. And yet, as an artist, as you know, the last bust made it almost impossible for me to find a studio space again. I know a lot of artists, creative people who need to leave because of our incomes just can't keep up with this. And what used to be maybe moving to Richmond, that's impossible.
Well, Carla, I hate to cut you off. We have to end the show. I'm so sorry. I mean, there are so many stories like this, and we will continue to do these shows. We're definitely going to work to have politicians on to find out what they are doing to truly address this crisis. So thank you for calling in, Carla, and sharing your story. And Katie, thank you so much for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Katie Murphy covers housing for the Mercury News and the East Bay Times. And I hope you can check out her interactive piece, The Price We Pay. It's at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to David LaTulipe, our studio engineer. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls Media Roundtable.